Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. While much of the nation and federal authorities are focused on immigrants, immigrant families, and immigrants entering the country without documents, the Federal Middle District of Pennsylvania that spans 33 counties is busy with a lot of other crimes in the law, including drug and gun-related crimes. We're joined today by the U.S. Attorney for the Middle District of Pennsylvania, David Freed. David Freed, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Scott. Nice to be back with you.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. As many of our regular listeners are aware, and Central Pennsylvanians aware, that you were the district attorney of Cumberland County before becoming U.S. attorney. How many months in the job now?
Just about 6 months.
6 months? All right, so what's different?
Well, I actually have some help. I have a Justice Department with lawyers and data staff and you know, all the things that you talk to your fellow prosecutors about when you're the DA and ask, you know, do you have numbers on this? Do you have numbers on that? What do you think about this? What do you think about that? I have a huge department backing me up now. Which really is a pleasure. The quality of the work in the office is very high. I had the distinct advantage of having worked with the office as DA. You know, every once in a while, we would have a case that we thought was better suited for handling at the federal level. Always had wonderful cooperation from the office in the Middle District. So I knew some of what was going on in the office. I've been pleasantly surprised to see the efficiency numbers in the office. And when you compare it to like-sized offices around the country, other offices within this Third Judicial Circuit, which is Delaware, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and the Virgin Islands, that we stand up very well. The quality of the work is very high, as I expected.
Mm-hmm. So what do those additional resources, and when I say additional, maybe that's not the right way to discuss it, but more resources than what a local district attorney would have, what does that allow you to do?
Well, if you think about it, you know, I think a great way to think about it is in terms of a drug case. You know, at the local level, we're dealing with street level dealing, and you know, occasionally you can work it up to maybe a mid-level dealer. Well, with federal resources, you have the opportunity to take that further up the chain, you know, and go after the bigger dealers and maybe have more of an impact on supply. Another great example is overprescribing physicians, and that's a huge issue all over the country. Depending on the year you look at it, I don't know that we have the final numbers for 2017, but we're right around fourth or fifth in the country in terms of number of drug overdose deaths.
Here. The Middle District, you mean?
No, the state.
Oh, the state.
The state,
okay.
Of Pennsylvania.
Okay.
And we have our areas in the Middle District where it's higher and some where it's lower. But those sorts of cases, as we all know, those of us who pay attention to the news, have a lot to do with overprescription. Now, there's been an incredible amount of work done. I have to give all the credit in the world to the responsible physicians, the physician general of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, who has really come out strongly in terms of prescribing guidelines. But we're still cleaning up the mess that's out there. And one of the things that state prosecutors have tried to do often, and sometimes with some success, is to really go after overprescribing doctors who are committing crimes. I have found in my time here that the opportunity to do those cases is there, and frankly, we're in a better spot to do them at the federal level. We just had a trial victory in a trial that was held in Wilkes-Barre with a doctor who was from Monroe County in the Poconos. He was found guilty of 30 counts, various counts, including one drug delivery resulting in death. We have a couple more of those cases pending. And as a state prosecutor, I was always anxious to do those and never really had the resources to be able to do them. And I think it's important that we do those at this level.
Why is it a federal crime?
Well, there's a couple things that distinguish federal crimes from state crimes, but generally, there's a federal criminal statute that criminalizes drug delivery, and the schedules are similar to the schedules we have at the state level. Generally, the way it's been done in the past is at the federal level, we have certain thresholds for cases, and my personal philosophy is, and I think it's shared by a lot of U.S. attorneys, if the penalties are about the same, we'll probably let the state folks handle it. Like, we're not doing small drug deals, generally. What makes these overprescribing cases federal? Well, they violate a federal statute against overprescribing, against drug dealing, you know, similar to the state's statutes, but we're really talking about higher level amounts and conduct.
You know, we've often heard, and I think you've even said this when you were on the program as district attorney, that this area of Pennsylvania is a corridor for drug activity because, number one, our proximity to big cities like New York, Philadelphia, Baltimore, Washington, but also the highways, the interstate highways. I-81 runs right through the Middle District of Pennsylvania, the Turnpike. You know, so many I-80 cuts across it. So are we, I don't even know how you can compare, but is the Middle District an area, a hotbed, I hate to put it that way, of drug activity?
Well, the drugs that we deal with have a lot to do with our accessibility. You know, if you go back and remember many years ago when homemade crystal meth was just ravaging the western part of the United States and the Southwest, and mostly in rural areas, we were very concerned in Pennsylvania that would happen here because, you know, we have a state with a substantial rural character. Well, the legislature did some good work and, you know, put the precursors for meth behind the counter at the drugstore and things like that, and we never really had a huge issue. A big part of that is because we are so close to drug source cities that the drugs were there. So people didn't need to make meth because they could get crack and they could get cocaine. And this is before we were inundated with heroin and opioids. But now we're in the same boat with heroin. Because we are so close, and Philadelphia is a major source city. Baltimore can be a source city. It's interesting, you know, in Cumberland County, when I was the DA, in different parts of the county, you'd see drugs coming from different source places. You know, in the southern part of the county, it might be coming up from Baltimore through Hagerstown. Yeah. And in the eastern part of the county where I live, you might see it coming from Philadelphia through Harrisburg. Well, it's very similar in the Middle District of Pennsylvania. You know, we have Franklin County where drugs come up from the south. We have the counties here in Dauphin and Cumberland, Perry, Franklin, York, where drugs come in maybe from Philadelphia, some from New York. And then as you go up into the northern, northeastern part of the district, you have drugs coming down from Binghamton, New York, some coming over from New York, and hear a lot about Paterson, New Jersey, and Elizabeth, New Jersey. So our transportation system and you know what makes us an attractive destination for all these trucking companies and warehouses and businesses that want to be within a certain amount of time away from the majority of the population on the East Coast, that makes us an easy place to get drugs to. Something else that's happening, Scott, that has been interesting to me is the amount of drugs coming through the mail. There's a substantial amount of drugs coming through the mail. Postal inspectors who do an amazing job are pretty much completely focused on drugs coming through the mail at this point.
How? What kind of drugs?
Cocaine, meth manufactured in Mexico, and then often goes through somewhere in the Caribbean. Don't necessarily see a lot of heroin coming through the mail. That's still coming, I think, over the borders.
So cheap and all out on the street, too.
Right, but it's been interesting to see how the amount of drugs that comes into this district through the mail. And state police does a great job working on package interdiction as well.
Wow, let's take a phone call from Bill in Harrisburg. Bill, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I was interested in hearing about the effect that the laws are having with regard to the drug manufacturers. I mean, you know, there was a huge scandal regarding the law that is basically allowing the drug manufacturers with getting away with, you know, sending out millions of pills that they shouldn't be. Is that being corrected?
Hey, thank you very much for your call. That's a good question because there have been some highly publicized cases, not necessarily in Pennsylvania or in the Middle District, but I do know there was one in well, I think it was Virginia, where there was a town or a city where there were, yeah, it was in Virginia, Southern Virginia, Appalachia, where just over, you know, anyone who would take a look at the number of pills that were sent to that town and the population, I think it was like some incredible amount of pills that each person in that town would have to use. Is that something that you look at?
So one of the first cases against a drug company by a United States attorney's office was in the Western District of Virginia. Which is, I don't know if they characterize our district, Scott, by size. We're a medium-sized district here in the Middle District of Pennsylvania. I'm going to guess Western District of Virginia is a small district.
I would think, yeah.
If not, they're a medium district that's been in the news lately. The town where I went to college, Lexington, Virginia, has been all over the news
these days. Yeah.
But
you go to Washington Lee.
I did.
Okay.
I did.
I know that Washington Lee produces a lot of lawyers.
That Western District took on one of the drug companies. What you're seeing more now is state attorneys general, as was done with the tobacco litigation, are all over this. You also have plaintiffs' firms going to counties and towns and trying to get them to join in litigation. What the Justice Department is doing right now is working with state attorneys general, including Attorney General Shapiro in Pennsylvania, which I think is a credit to him because I know he disagrees with a lot of what our Justice Department does and the president does. But the Justice Department is working well with the group of attorney generals to take the civil cases to the drug manufacturers, and that will really make a difference. Now, we know that'll be a battle, just like the tobacco litigation was, but it's long overdue.
Yeah, that will be a battle because they have what seems like endless resources as far as money in fighting these things.
They do. But you know what, Scott? We get paid the same no matter what. So we've got a lot of good lawyers, too, and I think we'll get a good result from that litigation.
You know, just in the few minutes that we've been speaking, you've mentioned cases throughout the country. I'm curious, how much information does a U.S. attorney get from the other districts throughout the country?
A substantial amount of information. Attorney General Sessions was an assistant U.S. attorney, and then he was a U.S. attorney for 12 years in Alabama. The Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein, who's also in the news quite a bit, was the U.S. attorney in Maryland for 12 years. And the leadership of the department right now are people who some call it the field. Some people don't like that. That doesn't bother me. People who've come up through the field. And there is a lot of focus on U.S. attorney's offices. You may have seen the announcement recently of an unprecedented expansion in terms of new U.S. attorneys around the country, assistant U.S. attorneys. We're getting three here in the Middle District of Pennsylvania.
Just saw that, yeah.
One to work on violent crime, one to work on affirmative civil action like healthcare fraud, and one to help us with immigration cases, which certainly we can talk about. And so there's a real focus on the U.S. attorney's offices. We get information all day long, every day. Now, this administration is big on one-page memos, which I can tell you as an office administrator, I love. So we get a memo that's a page or a page and a half. We get a lot of press releases on what the leadership is doing. And then we get a news digest every day. Scott, I think you've known me long enough to know that that's something I'm very interested in, to see what's going on around the country. So we also have meetings a few times a year with all of the U.S. attorneys, and that's an excellent opportunity to network. I've developed some relationships already with my colleagues in the state of New York, West Virginia, Kentucky in particular, states that have similar opioid problems to us. We find a lot to talk about together.
So that will help you in the long run, you think?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious. So you're in a position to see what kind of crime trends there are across the country. Immigration, which has gotten so much attention aside, let's just put that aside for a moment because we'll talk about that in a few minutes. But aside from that, what are some of the trends that you notice?
So it's interesting when we look at statistics, they always take the border states out of it. So you do, you put immigration aside because that's its own issue, especially for the border states. We don't have crossing issues here. And it's different depending on where you are. So if you look at the Middle District of PA, the biggest drivers of business for us on the federal side are drug crimes and violent crimes in particular gun offenses. One of the things that this district was doing before I even walked in the door, and I'm continuing and trying to expand, is identifying the places where we have the most violent crime and trying to direct resources into those areas. In particular, in this listening area, it's the city of Harrisburg and the city of York. There's extensive work done with federal agencies who bring on local officers and they swear them in as task force officers for the federal agencies. And those cases generally come right up to my office. So monthly, people from my office meet with people from the Dauphin County DA's office, Harrisburg PD, other departments from Dauphin County, and we talk about cases. And it's just this simple. We sit down with a stack of cases. The case is described to my, it's usually my deputy criminal chief, who says, yes, we'll do that one. No, we won't do that one. I've been to those meetings in Dauphin County. I've been to those meetings in York. We're involved in the call-in program in York and the gun violence initiative reduction. There's a call-in coming up in July, and I'll be down in the city of York for that. That's I won't say it's an intractable problem in the city of York, but it's a continuous issue, gun violence in the city of York, and we are directing resources as much as we can right to that issue. I think in 2018, we've certainly learned over time that the way to reduce crime, and look, our mission from Attorney General Sessions is reduce crime, reduce deaths from heroin and opioids. Very simple. Simple to state, not quite as easy to execute. So I've always thought, and certainly my philosophy has developed over time, that the best way to reduce crime is to direct resources to the areas where we can have the most impact, and that's what we're trying to do with federal resources.
And we'll talk about that again. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest today is David Freed, the U.S. Attorney for the Middle District of Pennsylvania. We're talking about crime and a lot of other issues. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Before we go back to the phone, Dave, I wanted to follow up on what we were talking about just before the break. You know, obviously, gun violence is an issue that if it was easy to solve, it would have been done by now. You said that you're a big believer in providing resources. How do we get a handle on gun violence? I mean, it's so many. In looking at your website information, when I, you know, my producers were looking into this, saw that there are so many guns involved with drug crimes, mm-hmm. too. How do we get a handle on it?
So if you look at what's being done in York, it's a great example of enforcement efforts and community engagement to try to engage with, in particular, youth who are most at risk of getting involved in this sort of behavior. The York Initiative, I may get the words wrong, but the mantra of the whole program is to young men, generally is young men, is we want you to be safe, alive, and out of jail. And you hear it from everybody involved in the program: safe, alive, and out of jail. So it concentrates on and this is intel provided by the York City PD, who's doing an amazing job with this program. It's focused on young men. They're generally on probably county parole or probation supervision. And the officers are out in the neighborhoods, and when a shooting takes place, they're informed and they're told from the outset, and everybody in the neighborhood knows, shootings bring police. So shootings happen. Police are going to get to the neighborhood, and if there's people walking around who have warrants for everything from unpaid parking tickets to serious crimes, they're getting brought in. District Attorney Dave Sunday is prosecuting all those cases because people need to know that enforcement's going to happen. On the other end, what the young men who are the focus of the problem or the focus of the program are told. When they're brought in for the call-in, and they're told all the time, they're given a card with a phone number on it, and they are told, call this number for anything that you need. And when they say anything, they mean anything. Do you need a place to sleep? Do you need diapers for a child? I think one time there was a dog who needed an appointment for the vet because this, you know, we're trying to rebuild lives and provide a base so that these people can succeed, you know, particularly these young men can succeed and stay out of crime. So we've got to build it from the societal level. And I, you know, I'm a law enforcement guy and we have to enforce. The U.S. Attorney's Office for the Middle District did a case over the last few years with about 30 defendants in the city of York. Numerous of those defendants got life in prison for their gang activity, being involved in racketeering and murders. There's still a few to be sentenced, but the general sentence for that case is about 15 years. When we go down to the call-in program, we have poster boards with pictures of all those young men generally from the neighborhood that these people know and say, if you're going to engage in this behavior and continue to engage in it, York City is going to send these cases to the feds, and this is what's going to happen. So we're focused on the enforcement end, but really what we need to do is build it up from the society level. That's how we're going to stop it.
You just said we're going to send it to the feds. Does that mean a tougher sentence? As far as a prison goes, I mean, okay, the reputation is that state prison is about the toughest you can get. Okay, and there are some who have a vision of, or you know, think what a federal prison is like. That it's not as tough time as what you would get in a state prison.
So generally, federal sentences, federal guidelines are higher than state guidelines. And what we're focused on in the Middle District and generally around the country are. People who have shown themselves to be violent criminals. One of the ways that we determine what case we're going to take is what's the potential penalty. When we're sitting down with York or Harrisburg or Wilkes-Barre or Williamsport, if the penalties are about the same, we're probably likely to say, well, let's just keep that case at the state level for now. We have a lot of really robust discussions about, you know, has this person's conduct graduated to the level where we should be prosecuting him federally? So we make those decisions based on penalties. You know, prison's not a pleasant place, no matter where you are. And Scott, that comes down to how the inmate is classified. You know, if you're classified as a lower risk inmate, you're going to go to a place that's probably not what everybody would envision prison being. If you're classified as a higher risk, you're going to go into a more secure environment. Certainly, state prison can be tough places. Look, there's county prisons around this Commonwealth that can be really tough places to be, and federal prison, federal penitentiary. Behind the walls, I can tell you, having visited and spoken with people who've been there, say there's nothing tougher than that.
Let's take a phone call from John in Mechanicsburg. John, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning. Go ahead,
John. You picked a heck of a time to go to work for the Fed.
I sure did, John.
I was the Cub Master at Sporting Hill Elementary School for 6 years, and in 2013 we lost one of the kids, and you are probably familiar with the case because it was prosecuted as a homicide. I'm looking for your views now as a federal prosecutor on prosecuting dealers that are cutting this material with highly toxic fentanyl and carfentanil that is resulting in the death of the user.
Hey, thank you very much for your call. It seems like every day we hear about a case where someone has OD'd on fentanyl rather than on heroin.
Yeah, that's a great question, and I appreciate it. As state prosecutor, there was a story that was done a year or so ago, maybe even a little more, by a reporter up in the Wilkes-Barre-Scranton area that looked at state prosecutions and the statute in Pennsylvania's drug delivery resulting in death. And it showed that as a state prosecutor, I was in my office, we were among the more aggressive offices in prosecuting those cases. Now, it's not just as simple as someone handing drugs to another person and that person taking the drugs and dying. You have to prove that the drug that they took was the drug that directly caused the death. I had a philosophical position, and I hold that philosophical position today, that if it is a sharing situation, if it's people that go to score drugs together and they're just sharing the drugs, I don't think that should merit the delivery resulting in death case. I wanted to go after what I called, for lack of a better term, the for-profit dealers, the people who are making money off of it, and I was proud to do those cases. There was one we did in Cumberland County that was able to attribute three deaths to one dealer, and he got a substantial sentence, I think something like 30 to 60 years, if I remember correctly. So at the and we're seeing more of that at the state level. In particular, Franklin County is aggressive on those cases. York County is aggressive on those cases. But everybody's doing them. Everybody's figured out how to do them, and they're doing a good job with them. There is a federal statute very similar to the Pennsylvania statute, and it's drug delivery resulting in death or serious bodily injury, which gives us an opportunity because the people who are saved by naloxone. That's serious bodily injury under the way the federal statute has been interpreted. That statute carries a 20-year mandatory sentence for a first offense. If the person has a prior drug conviction, the penalty for that goes up to life in prison. So what we have offered to our local partners is that we are here to do those cases. I just saw some numbers yesterday that we provided to the DEA of cases that we've done over the past few years. And I think we're at 15 to 20 throughout the district. We're ready, willing, and able to do those cases. My partners at the state level are doing them. They're doing a good job, and they're getting good sentences. So as long as that's happening, we're content to have them do that. I've been talking to the DAs in particular, though, about looking at their cases, and if it's a dealer who's a particular problem or somebody who's got a prior for drug dealing, we might want to talk about sending those cases our way.
Mm-hmm. I remember you saying when you were on this program before, when we've talked about the opioid crisis we're having, is that this is not something we're going to arrest our way out of. I mean, one of the real changes in attitude over the past 10 years or so is that it is not just a law enforcement issue, that we know that the people who are using, the people who are dependent, what I'm getting at here, are those, do you look at those people as criminals? Or, I mean, because one of the real criticisms of our justice system today is there are too many people behind bars who have been arrested for possession or just using.
Right. From the inside, I would say that the conventional wisdom that nonviolent drug offenders are locked up and the keys thrown away is far, far overblown. Now, at the level I'm at now, I feel very strongly that if we've got somebody who's a candidate for diversion because their crimes are directly related to their substance use disorder, that probably shouldn't even be a federal case. State prosecutors have much better opportunity to divert cases, to put people into treatment court, intermediate punishment, things of that nature. You know, we need to be focused on the bigger dealers, and for the most part, we are. Now, when we do big drug organizations, you'll have people at the lower end of that organization that we will battle about. And it's tough. You know, one of the things we have to do in a discretionary sense as a prosecutor is draw that line. Is the conduct more about making money than it is about feeding an addiction? And those are tough decisions. And I can understand it's not quite as simple as we're just locking up drug offenders. You've heard me talk for years about treatment, and treatment works when it's lengthy and meaningful. I was on a panel over the weekend with director of the Pennsylvania Emergency Management Agency. Well, you might ask, why was he on a panel about opioids? Well, because it's a public health emergency. And Senator Yaw from up in the Williamsport area, who's, you know, with his Center for Rural Pennsylvania, has had hearings all over the Commonwealth. A guy named Jason Snyder, who used to work for the state and now works in the treatment world. And the drug and alcohol director in Cumberland County. And it's that kind of joint effort that's going to get us where we need to go. But at the federal level, for me, I'm spending far less time on things like treatment and diversion because of the nature of the cases that we're doing. It's much more focused on enforcement.
Mm-hmm. So let's change gears here for a moment. As we've mentioned a couple times, obviously there have been the last 2 weeks that much of the nation's attention has been focused on what's happening at the border, who is crossing the border, what to do with the, you know, the families that have been divided. Here in the Middle District, how much of an issue is illegal immigration?
It's a fairly substantial part of our caseload. We are, I think, because of economic opportunity and the character of some of the jobs we have here, some of our agricultural jobs, we tend to be a destination for people who've crossed the border illegally. We have two detention centers, two federal immigration detention centers in the district. The one that's people around here have heard most about is in York. It's been in the news a lot over the years. And what we do in this district, we don't prosecute the border crossing cases. So there are different cases. The cases that are being talked about in Texas and California are different from what we have here. What we have here are people who've made it across the border illegally. And are living here as illegal immigrants. We prosecute numerous of those cases. We have a fast track program by the time the criminal case is done, they're generally being deported. They're not really spending time in federal prison. And what qualifies people for prosecution at this point in the Middle District of Pennsylvania is one prior removal. So you have a prior illegal entry, and then you have a prior removal. And then the person comes back. Then they encounter law enforcement. It's generally in a traffic stop or getting picked up for a state offense. That's generally how the cases come to us. Immigration and Customs Enforcement gets involved. The case comes up to my office. We prosecute it. And then they're generally convicted of the illegal entry and removed. So that's a substantial part of the cases. The family issues and the family detention haven't come up here yet. Now, because we have detention centers, depending on what happens with, there's litigation in California that should ultimately settle, at least for now, how it'll be handled. We don't know, to the extent that families are allowed to be detained together through that court decision, we may or may not end up with some here. We just don't know at this point.
We've heard a lot about zero tolerance from the administration, that someone who is undocumented in this country, that they will be dealt with. Has that had an impact since that policy has been implemented? Has an impact in the Middle District?
The zero tolerance is border crossing cases.
Right.
And the philosophy here, I think, under the previous administration was two illegal entry and removals would merit prosecution. So come illegally, get removed, come back illegally, get removed, come back the third time, then you would be prosecuted. So we've moved that down to one illegal entry, one removal, one return. Now we're prosecuting. So that has increased the number of cases, certainly. As a law enforcer, I have no problem with that. We have an assistant U.S. attorney who's actually detailed from Immigration and Customs Enforcement who does all those cases for us. That's all he does.
You've talked about cooperation, and one of the things that struck me as you've talked about it with the local authorities is that it doesn't sound like it's on we see on television where the feds are always battling with the local law enforcement. It doesn't sound like you have that kind of a battle going on.
We're pretty blessed here in the Middle District of Pennsylvania. I had some limited opportunity to work with federal agencies, FBI and DEA, ATF in particular in my almost 20 years as a state prosecutor. But I didn't have a great understanding of the scope of what those agencies are doing in the district and how well they do work with the locals. And look, the local folks are providing a tremendous amount of help. These people that are getting sworn in as task force officers are doing an incredible amount of work at the federal level.
What I was getting at with that question is that there are a number of places that have designated themselves as sanctuary cities for immigrants who are in the country undocumented. Has that caused any kind of issue for you as a federal prosecutor?
It hasn't yet in the Middle District. We have an opportunity through the Project Safe Neighborhoods program, which is a program that was started under the Bush administration, actually, and has been sort of re-energized under Attorney General Sessions. And that's focused on reducing crime. I think first time around, it was shown to reduce crime by 4%, which is pretty substantial. And we're going to get some resources here in the Middle District for Project Safe Neighborhoods. But in that program, for the federal resources to be awarded, there has to be a certification that people are complying with the law in terms of Sanctuary City. And those are the battles you're seeing in Philadelphia and California and places like that. That hasn't impacted us yet here.
Mm. Are there any places that have designated themselves as sanctuary in the Middle District?
I don't believe there's any that have designated themselves that way.
Okay. Moving on to some other issues. Financial fraud cases. Understand that this is something that may not get the kind of attention that the murderers, the drugs, all those do, but that you have a substantial number of cases like that.
So what the listeners may not know is that two of the biggest cases in the United States against money transfer companies. So Western Union, which many people are familiar with, and MoneyGram, big, you know, money transfer companies that move money all over the country and all over the world. Two of the biggest cases against those companies have been done and led by the Middle District and in particular the postal inspectors here, leading to the recovery of hundreds of millions of dollars for victims and helping those companies to get to a point where they're much better at preventing fraud. All these scams we hear about all the time, when the money's moved, it's generally moved using one of these services. And those cases are being done out of, you know, little old Middle District of Pennsylvania. And that's a real credit to the experienced lawyers in the office. This is an office where we have a substantial amount of experience, attorneys with 20 or more years of experience who know how to do these big federal cases. Scott, in the first couple of weeks on the job, I was down in Washington sitting around a table with representatives from MoneyGram and lawyers from the biggest firms in D.C. and representative from my office and talking about cases involving hundreds of millions of dollars. And again, those are the cases that the resources are there to do them at the federal level.
Mm. Sex trafficking, a lot of the same issues that we deal with. One of the reasons that this region is so attractive to drug dealers, same thing with sex trafficking. We're close to big cities. I get the sense sometimes that there are many people think, oh, this couldn't happen here in Pennsylvania, that this is something that happens only in big cities or in foreign countries. But it does happen often, right?
Absolutely. I don't know if you remember, but a number of years ago in Cumberland County, we did an operation focused on the truck stops. And what we found there was we could have a real impact on the supply. You know, once the word got out that we were doing it, the supply dried up, and we kept sending undercovers out there, and the demand never really dried up, unfortunately. As time has gone on, what we've seen here in the Middle District is the sex trafficking does take place. It's generally involved with drug activity and some violence. It preys on, in particular, young women and drug-dependent young women who are forced into this behavior and kept in that life by people supplying them with drugs. There was a substantial case that was tried back in December of 2017 with guilty verdicts involving trafficking in York County and Franklin County. There's a case pending right now in the Poconos, where we've arrested numerous people, charged them with human trafficking and sex trafficking. It was all being run out of a hotel in the Poconos, and we've actually seized that hotel and we're taking steps to forfeit it because it was the base for that business. Investigators have become very adept at taking those next steps and asking those questions when they have people who look like they may be victims of human trafficking. And look, they're difficult victims to deal with because they've been dealt an incredibly bad hand in life, and often they can't see a way out. But for those that think it can't happen here, I'm here to tell you it can, and it does, and it's happening every day.
I have a listener who sent an email, said, first of all, known someone who was in Dauphin County Prison and Pennsylvania State Prison. close to State College and report that the county prison was much harder to live than the state prison, to confirm that federal prisons notoriously have more amenities than state prisons. I hope he's not saying it's like one of those country clubs.
Just depends how you're classified.
Yeah. But also says you mentioned getting a one-page memo daily from the administration newsletter, which you like. What was the previous communication process like? Are there things publicly available? And what office individual do they come from?
So maybe memo is not the right word. We get every press release that's issued by the department and press releases from around the country that let us know what the offices are doing around the country. When we get a memo, it'll be on a matter of policy, and they're generally released publicly. You think of what's known as the Sessions memo, which speaks of prosecuting the most serious, readily provable offense. That's all available publicly. When the memo was put out about marijuana prosecutions, that was available publicly. So that's what I'm talking about there. The news that we get is simply a news digest. There's no editorializing. It just gives us links to where the department and different things that we're working on are mentioned. There's a significant portion of that that deals with cybersecurity, which is very interesting and a really hot topic.
Mm. We only have a couple of minutes left, Dave. Listener Mark wanted to ask your thoughts on mass incarceration.
Well, certainly I had more to do with that at the state level. And I just read an article yesterday about the difference in inmates going from Bucks County in southeastern Pennsylvania to the state level as compared to people from Philadelphia being sent to the state level, and there's a lot that goes into that. As you know, as a state prosecutor, I spent a ton of time on sentencing issues, sentencing alternatives, finding ways to keep people out of prison. What I see here now at the federal level is the people that we are prosecuting and the people that we're sending to federal prison, they need to be there. The legislature, I know, has worked on issues of sentencing reform. I think there's issues going on right now. Certainly, there were reductions in some of the crack sentences, which I think were shown to be a substantial hardship. One of the things that we are doing at the federal level that I'm very excited about is something called CARE Court, which is a reentry court. Again, you've probably heard me talk about this over the years. I think one of the ways that we as a system often fail people is when we send them back into society with no resources. And the CARE Court is a way that we can help people reenter. I'm a firm believer that you have to do your time. If you commit the crime and you're prosecuted, you're found guilty, you're given all the process that you're due, you have to do your time. But what we owe everyone, the people inside and outside the system, is the opportunity not to have to come back.
David Freed is the U.S. Attorney for the Middle District of Pennsylvania. Dave, good talking to you again. Thank you.
Thanks for having me back.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. After 35 years, the York St. Patrick's Day Parade may have ended. The committee that organizes and runs the parade has announced without more volunteers, 2018 may have been the last parade for St. Patrick's Day. Joining us is Dan Riley, president of the York St. Patrick's Day Parade Committee. Mr. Riley, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well.
All right.
What happened?
Well, we have been, like you mentioned, we've been going strong for about 19 years. Before that, the city of York ran the parade. They gave it up about 19 years ago, and it was rescued by a group of volunteers. And that committee's been running it ever since. What's happened now is that we've just had a few committee members who, for various reasons, life happens, they've had to take a step back. And without other people to step up and fill those roles, we're just not going to be able to have the manpower to put the parade on anymore.
So, usually when you hear a story about an event like a parade or, fireworks display or something like that, usually it's because of lack of money. Money is not an issue here?
Well, I mean, money's always an issue, right? We do have. It costs about $15,000 to put on the parade every single year. So we have to raise all of that money. We don't get money from the city or any other entity like that. We get all of our money from the donations, from small entry fees, and mostly from sponsorship, from corporate sponsorship. The real problem is the people, and we've put out calls for volunteers before, and it's always sort of fallen on deaf ears. I think people have the idea of, well, you know, somebody else will do it, but somebody has to kind of talk is cheap, as they say, right?
So when you say that money is always an issue, I mean, yeah, raising $15,000, especially sure. amongst volunteers, is not the easiest thing to do. Let me ask the question this way. Having fewer volunteers, does that make it more difficult to raise money?
Yeah, our committee's very small. We do have a lot of people who come out on the day of the parade. That takes about 200 volunteers or thereabouts. And again, that is challenging, but that, again, is not really the issue. We're not looking for people to come out on parade day. I mean, we are, but we can usually fill that. What we're looking for is people to be part of the committee, to meet fairly regularly leading up to the parade, and that takes about 8 months of preparation and occasional meetings. Everybody on the committee has a full-time job. And there's only about a half dozen of us or so on the committee anyway. So if we had more people, obviously more hands make light work, and that would help to ensure the continuation of the parade.
Is everyone on the committee Irish?
It's certainly not a requirement.
That's what I was getting at there. I'm joking with you a little bit. All right, so you say about six volunteers. What goes into volunteering? I mean, when you're having these meetings on a fairly regular basis, what mm-hmm. actually is happening? What would a volunteer have to do?
Sure. Well, there's many different jobs. My job, I do a bunch of things, but mostly, when we get closer to the parade, I send out the registration forms. I collect the registration forms, you know, talk to the participants, create the lineup. I'm just kind of the liaison with the people. We have a treasurer who deals with the money, obviously, as we talked about earlier. What we're looking for really is about five key positions, one person to do kind of overall coordination. Another person to kind of talk to local businesses and any business really about sponsorship. One person to kind of look into and deal with doing fundraisers and setting up fundraisers. Another person for graphic design. And lastly, social media and marketing or promotion of the parade. There are five key needs in order to make this go.
Why would someone want to do it?
Well, that's a good question, and that's, I think, part of the problem. Why or where everyone who wants to go and enjoy an event like this, and when it stops, they would say, oh, that's so sad, people should do something, but they don't necessarily want to be that person. You know, it's a civic event. We don't have too many civic events. I mean, we have a fair enough, but you know, I think we could argue that more is better, especially these days. We could use some more community building. And without people stepping up, then that's just not going to happen.
So, Dan, with the people listening to this today, there may be, and let's hope at least five, but maybe even more, who, after hearing this and understanding the circumstances, say, yeah, I'd like to do that. How could they get in touch with you or put their name out there that, yeah, I'd like to volunteer to be part of this St. Patrick's Day Parade Committee?
Absolutely, and we have gotten some good feedback already, some interested parties since we put this out on Monday. So I'm cautiously optimistic. But if you want to get involved, before July 15th, it's kind of our deadline to sort out where we are and whether or not the parade will go forward, July 15th, you can go to, we have a Facebook page, York St. Patrick's Day Parade. You can look it up on Facebook and contact us. We have an email address, which is yorkstpatparade@gmail.com. And we also have a website, York St. Patrick's Day Parade, which you can just Google and find pretty easy. We're not too hard to find.
Now, your website has all those things, too. If someone just does a Google search, they can find it very, very easily. Dan Riley is the president of the York St. Patrick's Day Parade Committee. I know there are a lot of people who have enjoyed the parade over the years and see it as a vital part of the community and would love to see this tradition continue, and let's hope that it does. Dan, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks very much.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, historian John Fea will be with us. He has a book out. It was just published this week on why evangelical Christians support President Trump in such large numbers. That's coming up on tomorrow's program. He's also going to be at Midtown Skyward Bookstore later this week. But John Fea talking about something very fascinating in today's political landscape, why evangelicals support President Trump in such large numbers. That's coming up on tomorrow's program, so be sure to tune in.